You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, does the rise of secondhand shopping mean bad news for those who need the affordably priced goods? We'll talk about the idea of thrift store gentrification with an expert on the life cycle of clothing. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear a case challenging a Mississippi state law that bans abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. The case could have a major impact on the legal precedent for abortion rights. It could open the door on a key part of 1973's Roe versus Wade decision, which found that states can't outlaw abortions before a fetus is viable. The court will hear arguments in the case after its next session starts in October, and a ruling is expected early next year. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the court agreeing to hear this case? Are you concerned about what could happen if the court lets states further limit access to abortion? Have you been hoping to see the Supreme Court take this up? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Mary Ziegler is a professor at Florida State University's College of Law. She's the author of several books on abortion law. The latest is Abortion and the Law in America, Roe v. Wade to the Present. Mary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Can you tell us more about this particular law out of Mississippi and how it made its way to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Sure. So Mississippi's law was passed in 2018. It bans abortions at 15 weeks with a few exceptions for medical emergencies and what the state calls certain severe fetal abnormalities. The law was, as most of laws like this are, where it was challenged in a district court and then in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is one of the most conservative appellate courts in the country, both of which said the law was unconstitutional for one simple reason, which is that it bans all abortions before fetal viability. So Mississippi took the position that essentially when fetuses or unborn children can experience pain, at that point, abortion should be illegal. And that's the state's position, but the Supreme Court has always said that that you cannot ban abortion for viability, which is usually sometime between the 22nd and 24th week of pregnancy. So in agreeing to take this case, the reason it's a big deal is that the court will, in order to uphold Mississippi's law, either have to strike down all or part of Roe v. Wade, right? We'll either have to invalidate all of Roe, or at least the piece that says that viability is crucial to the constitutional framework.
And as I understand it, the U.S. Supreme Court had kind of sat on this for a while, and it wasn't clear whether they were going to take it up as a case or how they were going to take it up as a case, how narrowly they were going to take it up. What do you make of that delay and then the decision, the announcement to say, yeah, we're going to do it?
Yeah, the delay was actually, I mean, it wasn't historically long, but it was puzzlingly long. So the court had originally been scheduled to start talking about this case in September of 2020. And here we are in May of 2021 before we actually get a decision. So it's always hard to tell exactly what the court is doing behind closed doors, but I think it's fair to assume that there was some kind of wrangling within the court's six conservative justice coalition. It's worth remembering that there only need to be four Supreme Court justices to vote yes to take a case, but there need to be five votes for the court to actually change the law. So my best guess is that there were potentially three or four votes for some time to take this case, but there may have been uncertainty within the conservative side of the court whether they could get that fifth vote to uphold the Mississippi law. And that's in part because there are different kinds of conservatives on the court, and exactly how those conservatives would feel about something as dramatic as overturning all or part of Roe, I think, is something that remains to be seen.
And then big picture, this is one state. A lot of other states seem to be taking up abortion laws, maybe with the U.S. Supreme Court in mind. Texas just today, I believe, was a 6-week abortion ban, banning abortions after 6 weeks, which is often before people know they're pregnant in the first place. Can you talk about the effort to find cases that are going to go to the U.S. Supreme Court and have another go at Roe v. Wade?
Sure. So states are really competing to be the ones that present the case that brings down Roe v. Wade. So since 2019, one kind of common theme has been so-called heartbeat bills that ban abortion when a doctor can detect either a heartbeat or fetal cardiac activity. That's usually somewhere between the sixth and eighth week of pregnancy. Texas's law, which just went into effect today, is kind of an interesting and weird variation on that theme, where the state isn't going to enforce the law. The state has outsourced that to private citizens in Texas, saying quite literally that anyone in Texas who learns that a doctor has performed an abortion after 6 weeks can sue that doctor for money under the state law. And we've really seen lots of other kinds of laws too. We've seen limits on medication abortion, limits on common abortion surgical procedures. We've seen laws about parental involvement, laws on informed consent. So really, I think what all of that translates into is red state lawmakers giving the Supreme Court kind of a menu of options to choose from. If the court wants to scale back on abortion rights, there are lots of alternatives.
Talking to Mary Ziegler from Florida State University's College of Law, looking at the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to take up a case from Mississippi that could curtail Roe v. Wade in all or in part. You could join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Now, we've got three Trump appointees on the Supreme Court. As President, Donald Trump had said he would appoint justices who would overturn Roe versus Wade. But maybe it's not that simple. Supreme Court justices are asked in confirmation about how they'd rule on cases like this. I want to give a listen to now Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett during her confirmation. This is last October, responding to whether she would commit to upholding the precedent of Roe versus Wade.
I will follow the law of stare decisis, applying it as the court has articulated it, applying all the factors, reliance, workability, being undermined by later facts and law, just all the standard factors. And I promise to do that for any issue that comes up, abortion or anything else. I'll follow the law.
Can you talk about that principle, stare decisis? And you know, even if the justices lean one way or the other, they're somewhat committed to following precedent.
Yeah, so stare decisis is a little bit misleading because it's a body of rules about when the court can get rid of past precedents. So just as a starting point, the fact that a precedent is precedent or is long-standing precedent doesn't really mean anything with respect to whether the court can overturn it. So conventionally, the court should be somewhat reluctant to overturn a precedent. So it shouldn't be enough to just conclude that a precedent was wrong. There should have to be some sort of plus factor militating in favor of reversal. And that's some of what you heard Amy Coney Barrett mentioning in that clip. So for example, the precedent is really hard to understand or apply in a coherent way for other lower courts. Or reliance, you know, that people have formulated their expectations or built their lives around an expectation that a ruling will be in place. And so I think when it comes to Roe in particular, there's literally an industry on both sides of the abortion debate of making arguments about just the kinds of things Amy Coney Barrett said, whether people rely on Roe or whether, in fact, legal abortion hurts people, whether Roe has been workable or not, whether science is undermined or reaffirmed the kinds of teachings of Roe. And so all of this isn't taking place in a vacuum. There's a pretty robust effort that's been really unfolding for decades on both sides of this question to convince the court to either affirm or turn its back on this precedent.
So, and I will not ask you to predict an outcome of this or any Supreme Court case, but people who expect stare decisis, this principle of being reluctant to overturn precedent, people shouldn't count on that as a deciding factor that's going to save Roe v. Wade. Is that fair to say?
That's fair to say. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think this particular group of justices has proven willing in even recent days, this week, actually, to turn its back on precedent. So just this week, on the same day that the court on Monday, when the court announced that it would hear this Mississippi case, Dobbs, was the same day that the court reversed a long line of cases involving rights for criminal defendants. So the fact that the court has a precedent or theoretically respects precedent tells us very little about what's going to happen in this case.
We're talking to Mary Ziegler, law professor at Florida State University, looking at the Supreme Court's decision to hear a challenge later this year to a 15-week abortion ban in Mississippi. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the legal side of the abortion debate and what kind of things might be on the table in the Supreme Court? Were you glad to see the court take this case, or are you worried about the court potentially chipping away at or reversing the ruling of Roe versus Wade? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Mary Ziegler, law professor at Florida State University, author of books including Abortion and the Law in America, Roe v. Wade to the Present. We're looking at the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to hear a case challenging Mississippi's 15-week abortion ban could have big implications for Roe v. Wade overall. You could join in with your thoughts, your hopes or fears for the Supreme Court getting involved here, and, of course, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Mary, I want to look ahead at the consequences if the U.S. Supreme Court, in fact, voted to effectively overturn Roe v. Wade. That doesn't immediately make abortion legal nationwide. It throws it to the states, right? So what could that look like?
Well, I think there are two things to note here, right? Overturning Roe wouldn't make abortion illegal, but that doesn't mean that people who are pro-life or anti-abortion will not be asking the court down the road to make abortion illegal nationwide. So in the short term, what overruling Roe would do would essentially allow states to do whatever they wanted. So we've already had a preview of what that would look like because lots of states have been passing abortion bans either at fertilization or at 6 weeks. I think many of the 6 week laws would probably give way to laws banning abortion at fertilization instead. And so many researchers estimate that roughly about half the states would criminalize all or most abortions if Roe were no longer the law. There would, of course, be some kind of deep blue states like California or New York that would continue to make abortion legal and available and probably publicly funded. And then there would be some kind of classic swing states like Wisconsin or Florida, where I am, where there would be a kind of even more heated pitch battle about what abortion policy is going to look like, because of course there would be no more federal limit on what lawmakers could do. And that's, I think, especially also true for states like Wisconsin that would be kind of regional hotspots, right? Because Wisconsin will be close to states where abortion will be criminalized. And so abortion policy in Wisconsin will affect not just people in Wisconsin, but people in neighboring states who either will or will not be able to travel into that to get an abortion. The only, I think, caveat in terms of if we're imagining a kind of return to a pre-Roe world is that, of course, now we live in an era where a medication abortion can be ordered on the internet. And the Biden administration's Food and Drug Administration is poised to lift some of the limits on access to that drug now. And so I think the other question we'll see going forward in a post-Roe America is really how effectively states that do ban abortion can enforce those bans, given that it's hard to monitor who is selling and buying this kind of drug online.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Oconomowoc. Mike, hi.
Hi, great. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a question really about it. I don't really think that this is going to overturn Roe v. Wade. I don't think that that's even possible, even with the court makeup. But what I am curious of is, where is the buffer zone between the anti-abortionists and the pro-life? You know, where is the common ground where maybe something could be reached, where maybe at some point in time we could put this whole debate to bed like once and for all?
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. 2 points there, Mary. First of all, his main point, is there a common ground consensus that we can arrive at some point? Mike wonders.
Yeah, I mean, I as a historian of this debate, I'm inclined to say no. But One thing that, and the reason for that, ironically, is not because Americans couldn't find a point of consensus, because if you look at polling, there's been fairly large majorities in favor in the United States of something that looks like legal abortion that's restricted and more access early in pregnancy and potentially bans or restrictions later in pregnancy. That's remarkably stable, and it's been that way since the 1970s. So it would not be hard to find an abortion policy that most people liked, because that's what large majorities of people in polls say they want. The issue is that the pro-choice and pro-life movements don't want that. And they're the ones who drive policy in the United States and really have driven policy since the 1970s. And for them, there is no common ground. I think from a policy standpoint, if we were looking for more kind of realistic ways to de-escalate the conflict, my hope would be that we could find issues that there could be common ground on. So just to take one obvious example that's been in the news recently, maternal mortality in the United States is unusually high in the developing world, for the developed world, excuse me. And that's something that, of course, has some bearing on abortion, because people who are worried, women or pregnant people who are worried about dying during pregnancy, may want to terminate a pregnancy they would otherwise be happy to continue to term. And so I would hope that in the future, groups on either side of this debate could look at the reasons people who may want to continue a pregnancy feel forced not to do so, and eliminate some of those pressures. But I'm not optimistic about compromise on abortion itself.
And Mark started off with kind of an assumption. He's skeptical that the Supreme Court, he said, even in its current makeup, would overturn Roe v. Wade. I read a piece you wrote, Mary. You think it's an open question, if I'm reading you right.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have on the court, we have six justices who were vetted by the Federalist Society and placed there partly with an eye to overturning Roe. Of course, President Trump promised that his nominees would vote to overturn Roe. It's also significant to note that there are six of them, right? So even if one of them had second thoughts, that would be not enough to save Roe. I'm with the caller in the sense that I don't really necessarily believe that the court would overturn Roe in this case, Dobbs, which we would know by June of next year. But I think it's much more likely that the court will kind of take Dobbs as an opportunity to kind of load the bases, if you will, tee up a subsequent case that will in fact overturn Roe. And I think we're more likely to see that in 2023 or 2024, which would of course be ironic, because 2023 is the 50th anniversary of Roe.
Talking to Mary Ziegler, law professor at Florida State University, looking at the case going before the U.S. Supreme Court. They've agreed to take it up later this year in a way that could challenge Roe versus Wade. Let's go back to your calls now. Nancy is with us in Arkdale. Nancy, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring
Hello?
Up, Nancy?
Well, the pro-life is, you know, fine for those that believe in it for them. But who is going to be financially bound to a child that wasn't wanted? We can't even get past right now the proposal for child care for people that have children and can't afford it. But now we want mothers to have babies that they don't want. And who's paying for this child until
Nancy,
it's...
I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Mary, I think this is a common policy argument that's brought up when you hear the abortion debate. Not something I imagine that would be considered too closely in the courts.
No, it's not. And it's also something that is sort of a weird artifact of our political party alignment on abortion. So it was not always the case that the Republican Party was the pro-life party and the Democratic Party was the pro-choice party. And at the time, then you could actually, you know, expect that maybe some lawmakers would say, actually, you know, you're right. If we're going to ban abortion, we should also have, you know, broader welfare protections, particularly maybe for newborns or for families with children or whatever. And there's some, you know, ideas like that floating around in Congress for, you know, child tax credits and so on. But for the most part, when we wound up with our current political party realignment, it's very hard to get for a Republican aligned movement to say, you know, the solution is more support from the government for people who are parenting. And that's one of the reasons that argument has some force.
Thanks for that call. Mary, one twist on this. I know there are some states, including Wisconsin, that have very old bans on abortion on the books. They were moot because of Roe versus Wade. The understanding, at least of some people here in the state, is that if Roe versus Wade was overturned, Wisconsin's law would be back in the books, and then an attorney general or local prosecutor could enforce that. Is that something you're watching for in certain states around the country?
Yeah, so a lot of states have actually tried to, I guess, states that are, have more robust or clearer pro-life slash anti-abortion majorities than Wisconsin have actually passed laws clarifying that that will in fact happen if Roe is gone. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have very progressive states like Massachusetts that have taken those old laws off the books. And so I think in Wisconsin, you're in a situation where, as you say, people are arguing that, but what would actually happen is a little bit less straightforward. And even whether prosecutors, I know there's been some question about that too, how prosecutors would actually enforce the law is ambiguous too. I think there are lots of states that have so-called trigger laws that would automatically go into effect if Roe was gone. Again, roughly half of them. And I think Wisconsin, I would expect to be more of a kind of a battleground state where you would certainly see a big push to punish people for having abortions and revive the state's old criminal law. But I don't know if the outcome would be preordained.
And Mary, as we wrap up, can you remind us of the timeline? When is the court going to tackle this and when are they going to rule?
So we should, the court goes on endless vacation, so nothing will happen over the summer. We would expect the court to hear oral argument in this case sometime in the fall, most likely in October, but we don't have a firm date yet. And then we would expect a decision in the case by the end of June 2022, and likely in late June of 2022.
Mary, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Mary Ziegler is a professor at Florida State University's College of Law, author of the book Abortion and the Law in America, Roe v. Wade to the Present. We talked about the U.S. Supreme Court taking up a case that could open the door for stricter state-level laws on abortion. As we heard, the court will hear arguments on that case probably this fall. Coming up, more people are shopping secondhand, and some people are buying items to resell often online. We'll find out if that threatens a thrift store's ability to get affordably priced items to people who need them. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, are you in the market for a new or used vehicle? You might have a tough time finding what you want, especially at the price you want. We'll find out what's causing prices to go way up and when they might come down. Now, many people, especially younger generations, have turned to secondhand shopping and thrifting as a way to build a closet full of items that are both unique and environmentally friendly. More people are buying clothing in bulk to resell online in places like Depop or share their thrift haul on YouTube or TikTok. But like any trend, it comes with some criticism. We've seen some thrift fans saying that the people who rely on inexpensive secondhand clothes are being priced out of the market at their local thrift store. Adam Minter is a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion and author of the book Secondhand, Travels in the New Global Garage Sale. Adam, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Adam, we saw a couple pieces on this here. There's a debate among the thrifting community. It looks like this worry that, hey, people are buying up too much stuff at their local thrift store and the people who really need the stuff aren't able to afford it anymore. What are you seeing?
Well, I think the operative fact, the most important fact to know about thrift stores in North America and in Europe is that they have more stuff than they can sell. And I'd ask you and your listeners to step back and just ask themselves if they've ever gone to a thrift store that's run out of inventory. And the answer is no, they haven't, because there is a tsunami of clothing, not just clothing, you know, electronics, furniture, all the stuff that we have in our homes coming through. And these thrift stores struggle to sell all this stuff. And when they can't sell it, they have to find other places to go with it. Sometimes it's outlet stores where they sell it by the pound. Sometimes it's export markets. But in the end, some of that stuff ends up being shredded. Some of it ends up being landfilled. And so any amount of people going in to buy this stuff is good. And the more who buy it, the better, because it lowers the cost for these thrift stores and allows them to keep operating.
And you talked about this a little bit on Twitter. The main point of these thrift stores isn't necessarily to provide cheap stuff to people in need. What happens when they make money?
Right. The point of, you know, most of your big thrift chains, and I'm talking about Goodwill, Salvation Army, St. Vincent de Paul, isn't to provide clothes to poor people. They certainly accept the donations, but ultimately they are nonprofits that are devoted to good work. So in the case of Goodwill, for a century, their main goal has been to provide job training to people, to get people into the workforce. And so they have extensive job training programs, and they're actually responsible for a shockingly high percentage of the people who are employed in the United States. The clothes, the clothing, the shoes, the computers, all the stuff they sell goes into paying for those programs. And so that's what these organizations are about. And they're very good at marketing their goods to do that. But, you know, despite, you know, sort of the reputation as being places for poor people to get clothes, that's not how these organizations have viewed themselves. And it's really not correct for people outside of them to view them that way as well.
This new trend out there, it looks like, is we've got some young, oftentimes entrepreneurs going to thrift stores, finding some good stuff, taking photos, putting it online, selling it, you know, making some money along the way. I don't know. What do you think? Is this good news that the stuff is getting where it's needed, or is it profiteering? Right. What's going on?
Well, let me say two things about that. First, I mean, anytime you have people reusing clothing, it's a good thing, because most of the clothing in North America does not end up being reused. Oop, did I lose you?
Nope, I still hear you.
Oh, okay. Second, you know, the deboppers, the people are selling on Poshmark, they're not doing anything new. And in fact, they're fairly small time. The biggest resellers working thrift stores in North America are actually immigrant communities, especially along the U.S.-Mexico border. Goodwill's, Salvation Army's, St. Vincent de Paul's in San Diego, Los Angeles, Texas, Phoenix, in as far up as Albuquerque. Their biggest customers are folks coming up from Mexico and South America, buying truckloads of stuff in these resale shops, these thrift shops, and bringing them back to Mexico and bringing them back to South America and reselling them there. In fact, it's fair to say that the thrift industry in the southern part, southwestern part of the United States wouldn't exist without this massive reselling operation. So when people talk about, you know, kids from the suburbs coming in and driving up the prices and taking away apparel from folks who can't otherwise afford it, you know, it's they're small timers, they're small fish compared to what's going on and people supplying into emerging markets. And it's not just Mexico. If you go up to Minneapolis, the Somali community buys enormous amounts of clothes out of the thrifts and sends them to Somalia. If you go out to the East Coast, you see Ghanaian and other West African communities doing the same thing. You know, they don't come in for criticism, nor should they. In fact, they're beloved by the thrifts for the simple reason that they help take the stuff out of the stores. And the kids coming in from the suburbs, the fashionistas, if you will, they're a small part of this, but they're benefiting this overall economy, allowing it to continue running.
Talking to Adam Minter, he's the author of the book Secondhand. We're looking at resale in the thrift clothing market. And Adam, in your book, you write, and we've talked about this on the show before, no matter how much reselling is going on, the big problem as you see it is that so much clothing ends up going to waste. At best, it might get turned into rags somewhere down the line. What can we do, I don't know, maybe on the supply side to have less waste?
Well, I mean, you know, the simple solution, of course, is, you know, is just to buy less stuff. But I always advise people to buy better. And by that, I mean, you know, if you're somebody who shops at Goodwill, if you're somebody who shops at Salvation Army, you're looking for that durable product. Well, everybody sooner or later is going to buy something new. And the way that I buy is I'm always buying new, if I buy new, with a second owner in mind. You know, maybe it's something that I donate. Maybe it's something I sell on Poshmark. Maybe it's something that I hand off to a relative. But again, you buy that better quality, more durable good. And I think we all know, you know, that can be more expensive and it can be harder. There's lots of fast fashion out there that disintegrates after a few washes. You know, I'd say if your concern is about clothing oversupply, don't buy that garment. You know, look to buy something that's more durable and that's going to continue to be reused. And that over time can help bend that curve downward.
as we wrap up, Adam, are you seeing a hunger for that in people, a trend toward people wanting to pay a little more now for something they know is going to last more than, you know, three or four cycles in the washing machine?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a genuine consumer trend. Right now, it's at the upper end of sort of the apparel market, but you do see it in outdoor brands, in particular brands like Patagonia. I hate to mention brands, but that's one of them that's doing it. And as that hunger for the more durable good and as that hunger to buy and sell into secondary markets grows, you see more response from these consumer brands saying, we can make a better product and supply it to consumers. So there is good news on the horizon.
Actually, before I let you go, Adam, for real this time, let's bring out a caller. Marshall is with us in Madison. Marshall, hi. Marshall? Well, Marshall reports seeing local Goodwill selling $4 to $5 pants. Now he says even discounted ones are $15. Something's going on with prices. We lost him on the line. But Adam, I don't know. Is there something to that? Will people see their prices going up locally?
It depends. Every Goodwill operates independently, but certainly their goal is to maximize the value that they get out of the donations they receive. They feel they owe it to their donors and they owe it to the mission that they have, which is, in the case of Goodwill, to provide funding for their job training programs. And clearly that's something that is needed more than ever. You know, it's worth recalling, though, that Goodwill does compete with other retailers. I mean, if you go and talk to the management, the business management side of Goodwill, they will tell you they're not competing, you know, with other used clothing retailers. They're competing with low-cost new clothing retailers, places like Walmart. And so they are not trying to push their prices up. But if you go into a Walmart, you will see clothing that's competitive priced with a Goodwill. So Goodwill's price pressure is actually to go down and beat the Walmarts and the other discount retailers around. So it's really a very complicated story.
Adam, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you so much.
Adam Minter is a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion and author of the book Secondhand Travels in the New Global Garage Sale. He joined us to talk about the rise in thrift shopping and reselling. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about chasing memories of youth with a fishing pole.
It's only human to want to relive the past, recreate the good old days, but it's a tough task. We often find it's just not quite the same. As an avid fisherman, author Ron Davis tends to agree, but that hasn't stopped him from trying.
The Greek philosopher Heraclitus once wrote, "No man ever steps in the same river twice." Back in 1972, I was a sophomore at UW-Eau Claire. I was pretty clueless then about what direction my life would take, just content to be in college and not Vietnam or working a grueling paper mill job like many of my buddies. One thing I did know, though, was that I ached to fish, desperate to find a place where a poor, boatless college kid could catch a smallmouth bass. One of my professors, a fellow angler, drew me a map of a secret stretch of the Eau Claire River I could access with my old Honda 350. So, on a crisp early fall day, armed with a cheap spinning rod bungeed to my sissy bar, I followed a labyrinth of township roads to a dirt path leading down to a section of the river canopied by overhanging trees. The water didn't look too promising, just an open pool about 30 yards wide with none of the usual rock banks and roiling currents you'd commonly associated with smallies. I waded in and the chilly water coursed around my blue jeans, as Jim Harrison once wrote, at the exact but varying speed of life. I made a few casts with a silver spoon, then had a line snarl and my lure sank to the bottom. But then the line moved, fish. A big smallmouth sprinted and breached all over the pool, but I finally lipped him, removed the hook, and gently lower the lunker back into the root beer colored water. Fifty years later, I moved back to Eau Claire, and again was jonesing for some piscatorial action. Larry Stordahl, an old friend, had taken me around to a few places on the Eau Claire he thought I could wade, including one practically in the middle of town. So, on a steamy July morning a week later, I decided to give it a try. Decked out in my fancy chest waders, carbide-studded boots, fly-fishing vest, and a preposterous caped hat, I felt a little self-conscious as I tried to edge my way down the steep, rocky bank sideways, but wound up sliding, stumbling, and finally gracelessly skidding on my butt to the shoreline, and cautiously worked the river a little with a floating rapala. Even though I was just a few blocks from Main Street, the steep slopes covered with greenery and flood-worn rock outcroppings cut me off from city life, other than the occasional honks and Harley revs that percolated through to break the spell. After a few hours of fighting the prospect of tripping and floating through the city center while I struggled to free myself from water-filled waders, a medium-sized smallmouth hit and gave me a nice bite, a lovely bronze-backed fish, which angrily darted back into the depths after release. Swaddled in all my gear, the heat by then had me breathing hard and swimming in sweat. I thought about things like heat stroke, wrenched knees, my cell phone left in the car, old man worries that made me surrender and set to clawing my way on all fours back up to civilization. I suppose you could say the Eau Claire was the same river I had found in my college days, at least in name, but I definitely wasn't the same man. As Harrison also wrote, advancing years can kick you hard, but fishing a river, you forget the kick.
Ron Davis is a retired English teacher and the author of Shiny Side Up, Musings on the Improbable Inclination to Travel on Two Wheels. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberger.
Coming up, we'll find out what's driving up the price for used cars. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. If you're in the market for a used vehicle, you might not want to be too picky about the make, model, color, mileage, age, and options, and you're probably going to have to pay more than you want to. There aren't too many used cars available. Why? Partly the pandemic. It's causing prices to go through the roof. J.D. Power says the average cost of a used vehicle is over $25,000. That's the highest they've ever seen. It's gone up more than $3,600 over the past 4 months alone. So maybe you're wondering if you ought to spring for a new car. Well, they're in short supply too, forcing people to go over the sticker price sometimes to get one. Might be a while before prices and inventory return to normal. Jamie Page Deaton is executive editor of the U.S. News Best Cars team. Jamie, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I understand, Jamie, you have a used car you're trying to sell. What are you seeing?
I am seeing way more money than I thought I would ever get offered for this car. You know, for a little bit of context, my husband and I, we have two cars and we're thinking about going down to one. So we went out and it's so easy to do now. You can go to sites like Carvana or Vroom or Kelley Blue Book and you can get an instant cash offer for your car. And so we went ahead and did that for our 2016 Toyota 4Runner. And we have offers, you know, ranging from, almost $34,000 down to $27,000. And this is incredible because we only paid, when the car was new, we only paid $36,000. So if you look at, you know, our highest offer from, you know, 2016 to now, if that, you know, if we were to take that offer, we will have only spent, you know, $4,000 in lost value on this car, which is incredible. I've never seen anything like this, you know, not only for myself, but also just industry-wide in nearly 15 years in the automotive industry. Things are just really crazy now in the used car market.
Yeah, this is not just something magical about your car. This is all over the place. What is going on with used cars?
So there, it is a perfect storm. There are a number of different factors going on. Number one we had last year was, of course, the pandemic. And what happened there was car rental companies, they dumped all their inventory right there. Usually car rental companies they're buying a lot of new cars. And then 18 months later, they're selling a lot of used cars into the used car marketplace. So that drives a lot of the supply in used cars. Last year, they dumped them as soon as, you know, the pandemic hit. They haven't been able to buy new cars. And so because because there's not that big sell-off of used cars coming from rental car agencies, there's less supply in the used car marketplace. And that's creating a lot of issues there too. You also have the impact of the new car marketplace on the used car marketplace. New cars are also in short supply. There's major shortages for computer chips, for foam, for seats. There are shipping delays, all of these things kind of just related to, you know, the pandemic. And what do we have? So that means that buyers are finding prices for new cars to be really high. So buyers that would have normally bought new are now showing up in the used car marketplace. And that's further constraining supply. And then the other thing that you're seeing too is a lot of demand. You know, people who last year may have put off buying a car because of economic uncertainty or the fact that they knew they were going to be home for a year are now starting to enter the marketplace. So it's really just, you know, old fashioned economics. There's limited supply and a whole lot of demand. And that means that prices are going up.
So, Jamie, the economics of car ownership might be changing now. If somebody had a car, it's like, oh, that's some expensive repairs. I'm going to need to keep this on the road. Maybe that is worth doing now instead of paying way too much for a used or new car.
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, those car repairs that are maybe a couple $1,000s are going to be a lot less than the price of a new or new to you car. You know, if the average price of a used car is now over $25,000, I have yet to see car repairs that cost $25,000. So it's, you know, it's one of those things too. If you can wait, if you do not need a new car now or a used car now, if you don't need to replace your current ride right away, just wait this out. And, you know, most analysts are thinking that early next year, things will start to settle down quite a bit and we'll start to see prices, you know, get a little bit more reasonable. But the flip side of it is if you have a car that you're looking to get rid of and you don't need to replace it, that's the key thing. If you don't need to replace it, then yeah, strike while the iron is hot. Go out, get an offer for that car, sell it, you know, live car free for a while or live with just one car for a while and take advantage of this market.
You talked, Jamie, about that timeline to getting back to something close to normal. But what kind of things are you looking for that are going to need to happen for this supply-demand mismatch to resolve itself?
So a number of things are going to need to happen. First, you're going to have to see increased supply on the new car side. Like that's just kind of goes without saying. What we're also going to have to see, though, is new car sales continue to pick up because included in there are new car leases. And that's another major driver of supply within the used car market. It's cars coming off of leases. So, you know, 2 years after a car is out or 3 years after a car is out, that's when you start to see that, you know, that model enter the used car marketplace. And what we saw in 2019, at this point in time last year, of course, people were still largely panicking over the pandemic and, you know, economic uncertainty. Starting the fall of 2019, though, new car sales started to pick up. And that's where we'll start to really see used cars entering the marketplace. The other thing, too, is, you know, you really just have to kind of, you know, wait for the, you know, chip issues and the other supply issues within the new car area to get kind of worked out. Those are the ones that are going to resolve the fastest, but that's going to take those buyers that want new cars that are being pushed out of the new car marketplace and heading to used cars, that's going to pull them back into new cars. And so if you can wait those buyers out, you'll be in a pretty good position.
All right, Jamie, I'm going to ask you the impossible question, the Kobayashi Maru question here. If somebody's out there thinking, I need a new car now, I really don't have a choice, what advice do you have for them to make the best of this crazy market?
So a couple of things. One is be flexible. The odds of you getting the exact make, model, and features and color that you want at the price you want, like that's a pretty low likelihood right now. So make sure that you're being flexible about what you're considering. The other thing is to swim against the current with this. Go looking for cars that are maybe a little bit less popular. We know that Americans, you know, we love our SUVs, we love our trucks. Start looking at, you know, compact cars, look at hybrids. You know, these are all things that are a little bit less affected or a little bit less affected by supply constraints because they aren't, you know, really as popular. They don't have quite the demand there too. The other thing, and this is a little bit weird, is, you know, the luxury car market tends to be a little bit more insulated from these swings because they don't expect to build quite as many cars anyway. So you can actually find some really good deals on luxury cars within used cars. So make sure that as you're comparison shopping and you're looking at the price of, say, something like a Toyota Camry, that you're comparing that with, you know, a used Lexus ES, because those Camry prices might be starting to be getting, you know, pretty high and start to overlap, and you can get a little bit nicer car for your money. If you're going to pay extra, you might as well get extra. And this is another one that also might fly in the face of kind of conventional wisdom. If you're searching for used cars and you're going to get a loan, check out new cars as well, because in a lot of cases, some of these used cars are inching up in price to being really close to the new car. And even if the used car is a little bit less expensive, you're likely to pay more in interest for a used car loan. So if you take the example of my 2016 Toyota 4Runner, if it's listed at $34,000 and the MSRP for a 2021 is $36,000, there's only a $2,000 difference there. So if you can get a lower rate on a new car loan, get the new car and save your money on interest. So just make sure you're running all the numbers and be willing to go against kind of, you know, some of the more conventional wisdom about car buying and how to save money, because goodness knows that this market is going against conventional wisdom too.
Jamie, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Jamie Page Deaton with the U.S. News Best Cars team looking at a big jump in prices for used cars. Tomorrow on the morning show, vaccines for 12 to 15-year-olds. Get the latest on COVID-19 and kids. That's tomorrow at 7:30. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.